Okay, we're on lesson 7 and we're looking at the questions. So we're looking at denominationalism from a sociological perspective. And this is based on what historians have observed in religions. Religions move from what is called a sect to a denominational way of thinking. And on lesson 6, we had a chart with some of the characteristics of the way of thinking that characterizes a sect, and then some of the ways of thinking that characterizes the denominational way of thinking. And in that particular lesson, under the column about sect, we noticed that members believe they have the truth. But in time, as they make this transition, they're less dogmatic and they're less willing to argue about what is right. They just want to get along. And then the characteristics of the sect, according to the historian, would be they believe themselves to be the church, the church. But as people progress in their thinking to this other way of thinking, they're much more tolerant of other churches. Not willing to exclusively talk about one church. Then in the sect way of thinking, they are strict morally, whereas you move to the denominational way of thinking, moral standards are reduced. They're colored by and tend to conform to society. One of the reasons for that is, obviously, if you want big numbers and you want to be popular, and that's what you're going to have to do. And then the sect way of thinking, people are more fervent in their religion, devoted, sacrificial, whereas in the denominational way of thinking, they're more interested in politics and social life and sports and other activities in the world around them than in religion. Now, when we studied that, those four characteristics that sociologists would associate with a sect, where else do you find those particular characteristics? Those four we talked about. In the New Testament. That was characteristic of the early Christian. Those very, very things. The idea of fervency, the idea of believing they had the truth, the one true church, and certainly a standard of morals. People did not accord with it, they would withdraw from them. So much so, even about working for a living. 2 Thessalonians in chapter 3. All right, so we looked at that in our first lesson. In the second lesson, we had another list by another historian, some of the same things, but more specifics that he outlined in our questions on lesson 7 are somewhat growing out of both lessons. So let's look at question number 3. You're moving to a new town. There are two churches of Christ in town. One has 500 members, a beautiful building, a paved parking lot, a full-time preacher, and a budget. $10,000 per week. The other has 50 members, a small, older building, a gravel parking lot, and the members must assist in the preaching as the preacher they support works secularly also. Based on this data, which church will you join? Good answer. That's an excellent answer. This data doesn't tell you, does it? That's great, Betty. It's not the size, not the building, not the budget. Betty said, based on its teachings and what else? And its views. That's right. So that's what you look at. Are they following the New Testament pattern? Do they emphasize the truth of Jesus Christ is the foundation of their thinking and practice? That's an excellent answer. So I put that on there because we've been talking about this transition. We may think, that maybe some of this is saying it's wrong to have a big building, big numbers, and a big but. No, it's not wrong to have that. That's not necessarily indicative of the fact that people's thinking has become loose. There are big churches that are sound churches. Can you think of a big church in the New Testament? Jerusalem, pretty big church, wasn't it? That's right. But they were continually devoted to the apostles' doctrine and fellowship, the breaking of bread and prayer. And the gospel was preached there in Jerusalem, and people were persecuted for it. In fact, some of the saints began to disperse because of that. And so that was a large church that was a good, sound church. Appreciate the fact you're alert to this question. I don't mean it to be a trick question, but I want to see how we thought about it. You're a great answer. Appreciate that. In an assembly of the congregation for worship, number four, should every Christian have the desire and feel the obligation to sing? Or is it better to let those who know music and can carry a tune well do the singing and others simply enjoy and be edified by their good singing? Explain. All right. That's got a good answer. Ephesians 5:19. So there, what is it in that particular text that indicates individual involvement in the scene, Ephesians 5:19? Okay, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to just do melody in my heart and let everybody else do the singing. That's it. Speaking to one another. As Matt has said, there's no discrimination about who the singers are. It's the congregation speaking to one another. Where is the passages in the New Testament that emphasize tempo and tuning and speed and that kind of thing? There isn't any. Does that mean song leaders shouldn't work on that? Certainly not. Because our singing needs to be such that it's edifying. And if we sing songs that are designed to be, in their very nature, rousing songs, like their funeral dirges, that kind of takes away from the intent of the song. Vice versa, there are songs that are designed to be sung very slowly because of their content. We don't want to sing them like a marching to battle song. So there is something to be said for certainly timing and for pitch. You get a song too high, people can't sing, or too low. But those are not the things that are stressed in the New Testament. We're aiming, whatever we do about singing, is to fulfill Ephesians 5:19, Colossians 3:16, speaking to one another, edifying one another in song. That's right. Just a passing note, kind of a tangent, but I'm going to take just a moment to mention it. When you talk to people about vocal music, that this is what the New Testament talks about, where do they normally take you? To the Psalms, to the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, you do read about instruments of music. But why is it that that picture, if you understand what their practice was, why is it that that particular fact does not help their case? Probably not a good question, but there it is. Singers, that's right, singers and the musicians. So it wasn't that every Jew came to the temple or the tabernacle and brought their harp or whatever it may be. It wasn't that at all. As Linda said, there was a special group among the Levites that were appointed singers and musicians. And so really that doesn't help their case as far as the idea that the congregation, everybody can use some kind of an instrument. By the way, if Ephesians 5:19 is teaching that we ought to use instruments in worship, who ought to use them? Everyone. Everyone. Again, Matt has pointed out there's no discrimination. That's right. Okay, so, but we're in a society, we want to be entertained. We want it to sound good, and we want that to appeal to people. So we have in churches today stages and bands and performances, and that draws people. People are entertained by it. But that should never be our emphasis. And when that becomes an appeal, that may be a sign that we're making this transition in the way that we think. So, I know I grew up going to churches, gospel meetings, and other churches that I attended, sometimes just small buildings, flat roof, found people in there, and boy, the singing was great. Didn't have the acoustics like they talk about today, but man, the singing was great. People just opened up and sang. Very edifying, very encouraging. Number five, do you think the local church should be more involved in providing social services and providing direction on political issues that affect the lives of people? No? Why not? Good answer. Wasn't part of the pattern in the New Testament. Very good. And in 2 Timothy 1:13, Paul told Timothy to hold the pattern. Then in 1 Timothy chapter 3, he told him what his work was as far as that local church there in Ephesus. It was to be what? Pillar and ground of the truth. Not political truth, not social truth, but the truth about Jesus, which he stated in verse 16. In the coming months, guess what churches are going to be talking about? The election's coming up. So there are going to be politicians speaking in churches. And it's like, well, shouldn't we be interested in our government? Yes. Should we be interested in our community? Yes. But that's not the purpose of the local church. But the more you move to this denominational way of thinking, the more you have that. And unfortunately, in some churches of Christ, you have that movement toward that area. So instead of emphasis on what we're doing tonight, just opening our Bible and studying, current issues become dominant. And that's sometimes reflected in the sermons you hear. Number five, do you think the local... Well, I just asked that one. Number six, do you think churches of Christ are in the midst of a transition to a denominational... to a denomination sociologically? Ma'am? Call them back. I'm afraid so. You know, some of these things that we listed, like unwillingness to discipline someone, acceptance of the culture and society around them. For example, women being leaders in the assembly. Many churches of Christ have women who are leading in the assembly. Oh, yeah. There are people who would not be comfortable at all going to a small building that didn't have a really nice facility, for example. And so anyway, there's a number of these issues that we've talked about that I'm afraid are marks that we're making this transition. Now, the next two lessons is looking at denominationalism from a different perspective. So lessons 6 and 7 looked at it from a sociological perspective. These next two lessons are looking at denominationalism from an organizational perspective. And I'm hoping that we certainly understand what we're looking at as we study this. Because this is not a question of whether or not are we on the road. Fact is, the Churches of Christ are definitely involved in the denominational type organization. And we'll see that as we study this particular lesson. All right, but to begin our thinking, we start with something that I think most in this class are familiar with. You've been through the classes on the church or heard lessons on the church here. Doug just taught a series on the church here in the auditorium. And we talked about this concept of collective noun. Do any of us use collective nouns outside the assembly and talking about religious things? Can you give me an example? Family is a collective noun. It's the people you have grouped in your mind on the basis of some common connection, family relationship, blood. And so, any of you watch Astro Ball Players? You want to talk about all the Astro Ball Players as one, what do you call it? Team. That's what a collective noun is. Now, let me ask you this question. If you went into a restaurant and there were five ball players sitting at the table sharing a meal, one was an Astro, one was a Yankee, one was an Oakland A, one was a Baltimore Oriole, and one was a Dodger. That's five ball players. Is it a team? But that's plural. Okay, there's not that common connection. You're not grouping them on the basis of the fact that they're joined together in this, whichever team it may be. That's right. And so that's important in a collective noun. It's not just a plurality. It is a plurality. One person cannot be a collective noun. One person can't be a team. One person, one bird can't be a flock. One link can't be a chain. But because you have a plurality, doesn't mean you have a collective noun. If you go to the hardware store and you see a bucket of links, you know, make a chain out of links, you buy that bucket of links and take it home. Do you have a chain? No. It won't tow a car. A chain is, are links connected by physical connection, the idea. So when we talk about the church, it's not just a plurality of Christians. It takes more than one Christian to make a church. The church is a collective noun. But they're linked together somehow. And the somehow determines the various uses of the word church in the New Testament. You say, this is all technical stuff. No, it isn't. You do the same thing. If I talk about, now, Rocky talked about the word family. You ever heard the phrase, the Ford family of fine cars? Is that a collection of people related by blood? No, same word, see? But different units that are collected for one thing. And another thing connected is the difference in the connection that they have. You're taking cars, and they're all manufactured by the same maker. Now, let's just take family and relate it to people. If we are talking about Jeff's a gangster, and so he runs this gang syndicate, and we say we better be careful because Jeff get his family on you and bring revenge. What's he talking about? The mob. That's right. Same word. Collecting people. But this time you're looking at a different connection. Not a connection by blood, but a connection based on their commitment to work together for whatever their purposes are, rob, steal, whatever it may be. So that's just the nature of collective nouns. And same thing with the word church. It's a collection of people, particular kind of people, saints. And what that connection is determines one of the four ways that the word is used in the New Testament. Okay. So I have a definition here from the American Heritage Dictionary. It has some examples of collective nouns: committee, company, clergy, enemy, group, family, flock, team. And so it's when you take a group of things or people and view them as one, as a unit in some way. All right, now the word denomination is a collective noun. Where church always collects what? People. Denomination is a word in our language, it's not in the New Testament, that collects churches and ties them together in some way. There are different ways. And so how you use denomination depends on how you're connecting these churches. You may do it by theology, agreement to a certain religious view. But you may do it by the fact that they work under a centralized oversight. Yes, Todd? You could put it that way. As long as you understand it's the group as a group. It's not just multiplicity. That's right. And church collects individuals and denomination collects groups if you want to do it that way. Okay, good. All right. And these groups, remember, are not just a bunch of people. It's people that are bound together in some way, a collective group. Okay. So we have the word church here in the two basic senses in the New Testament. It's used two other ways. But here are the two primary ways it's used, the church in a universal sense and the church in the local sense. And we have some very common verses, I think, to everybody in this class. The church in the universal sense collects all saved people. Acts chapter 2, verse 41, those that received his word were baptized, and verse 47 says they were added to the saved. And then in the word body, that's just an analogy to make a point. The church is not literally a body with a head. That's an analogy. But when the New Testament uses that analogy, the people are members. So I do want to go to 1 Corinthians 12. If we were going to use the word church, and it is used this way, in the denominational sense, as a collectivity of churches, who would the members be? The different churches. I'll read something to you in a minute that shows, if I get to it tonight, I think I will, that shows that is exactly the concept. The member churches of that denomination. But here in 1 Corinthians 12, he uses the concept of body. You look at verse 12, as the body is one, yet has many members, and all the members of the body, though there are many, are one body, so also is Christ. For by one Spirit we were all baptized into one body. That's clear then that the members are people who, upon their faith in Jesus, guided by the Spirit of God to understand and believe the gospel, have been baptized into Christ. So the context helps us out there. And verse 27 says, you are Christ's body. And using a term Todd used a while ago, and individually members of it. Then in John 10, we don't need to turn there. You're familiar with Jesus' illustration about flock. There'll be one flock. one shepherd. Of course, they're talking about people. This time they're being viewed as sheep, because his teaching there was that sheep know the voice of the shepherd and follow the shepherd. That's the idea there. And then in 1 Peter 2:5, the idea of a building which God dwells, and the people are like stones in the building, forming a dwelling or a habitation of God. So these are just analogies that are used. But the church, and like these analogies, I don't know of... we have to be careful in any context in which we see it to know whether it's talking about the church universal or the church local. I'll leave it that way. And then locally, saved people working together in a given locality. So you're very familiar with 1 Corinthians 1:2, to the church of God which is at Corinth, to those who are called to be saints. So that group was a group of saints or saved people working together. In Philippians, I do want to turn over to Philippians chapter 1:1. It's an excellent passage to show the composite parts of a local church that had reached some degree of maturity. Verse 1, to all the saints in Christ Jesus who are at Philippi, including the overseers and deacons. So overseers and deacons are saints, but they have a special role. But if you want to try the church in Philippi, here who composes? Saints, overseers, deacons. Now, when this church wanted to help the apostle, chapter 4 and verse 15, he said, "You yourselves know, Philippians, that at the first preaching of the gospel after I departed from Macedonia, no church shared with me." I know that you can't tell it by your version, but he used the collective noun with a singular verb. He says, so what? Here's the so what. Here's two statements. My family is large, my family are large. Both of them are grammatically correct. What's the difference in meaning? What? That's right. My family is large, a lot of people in it. My family are large, maybe they're all tall people, for example. And so, when you use the singular verb, you're looking at the collective as a unit, as one. And so he's talking here about what we do right here. When we put money in the treasury, and that money then is sent to some preacher, the church, it, as a unit, has fellowship with that. And every individual Christian that contributes has a share in it. As you see in this verse, he uses the word Philippian, plural, but they're working together as one through that collection. Okay. The word denomination is unknown to the New Testament. This is an illustration we used in our lesson on the church. You have a link. You have links. We have a word to describe those links that are connected by a physical bond. We call it a chain. Plurality of links do not make a chain. But when you connect them, you have a chain. You can have a Christian, you can have Christians, plurality. When you connect them by some bond, you have a church. Yes, Ennis? certainly a good thing to be, try to be sure they understand. They're not joining a denomination. They're coming into a fellowship with Christ, with all others who are in fellowship with Christ, a body of saved people. That would be good to be sure they understand. And so that's the church. And then you have the term church, plurality, churches. What word collects churches? That's the word denomination. Now, I have some verses. 1 Corinthians 1:2. What does that talk about? The church at Corinth. A church. One church. Right? What does Romans 16:16 talk about? Churches, plural. Now, Romans 16:16 is where you find the concept of a church composed of churches of Christ, correct? Correct? No. It's just a plurality. You say, but if you gather all the churches of Christ together, isn't that the church? No. You can gather all the links for chains in a city and put them in a bucket or in a barrel. You still don't have a chain. And so all Romans 16:16 is a plurality. You have plurality of Christians and not have a church. I put Matthew 18 on here. Because in Matthew 18, how do you show from Matthew 18 that a plurality of Christians is not a church? Somebody said, well, prove what you're saying to me. I know that one Christian is not a church, but if you got more than one, you've got a church. How can you prove that's not true from Matthew 18? Excellent. So if you've got the two or three witnesses, Christians, he's already heard the church. And yet Jesus said, if you won't listen to them, tell it to the church. And if you refuse to listen to the church. And so, very good. All right. Denominationalistic views of the church. The church equals a specific denomination, like the Methodist Church. Would be a collectivity of Methodist churches. Okay. I want to read something here. I'm going to read a little section here and from a couple of different sources, and maybe you can identify the preacher. Maybe you've heard him preach or something. Okay. Some Christian denominations include all their congregations in one comprehensive society or ecclesiastical system under some central authority, which legislates for and controls the whole. The comprehensive society they call the church. Thus we speak of the Roman Catholic Church, the Episcopal Church, the Presbyterian Church, where the word church stands for the aggregate of all their local societies. A little further down he says, a church, therefore, is not a system of congregations confederated under a general government, but a single local congregation of Christian disciples associated in covenant and meeting together for worship. In this sense, the word is commonly, almost uniformly used in the New Testament. Unquote. You ever heard that preacher? Sound like some gospel preachers maybe you've heard. Do you agree with that? I'm not trying to trick you. Okay, I'll step out. I think it's excellent. You may never guess where I got it. What? No, it's a standard manual for Baptist churches, 1958, American Baptist Publication Society, written by Edward T. Kiscop. Oh, it's just a bunch of Church of Christ people or a bunch of aunties or a bunch of conservatives. No, that's even this guy recognizes that. Here's one more. The New Testament knows nothing of an aggregate of a denomination called by the name of church, as the Presbyterian Church, the Methodist Episcopal Church, the Roman Catholic Church. In the days of the apostles, they had churches, but nothing visible and tangible, organized in any shape and known as the church, except local congregation, as clearly seen from the above scripture. The term church is never applied to the scripture to any aggregate of churches, either territorially or ecclesiastically. He goes on to say, errors in the formation and government of churches lead to errors in doctrine and practice. Remember talking about the railroad track? You start veering one place, you get further away. I know you've never heard this guy. It's in a little track I've got. It's called What Baptists Believe and Why We Believe It by J.G. Bow or Bow. What I'm trying to show you is that this is not something unique that we've discovered. Nobody else knows it. It's recognized from the study of the New Testament. And so this concept that we're presenting here in Lesson 8 is certainly a biblical concept and recognized by the Bible students. Yes, sir. All right, let's look at Acts 20:28, since Todd brought that up. You say you actually heard that used of the Church Universal? First of all, if it's talking about the Church Universal, what are the consequences of it? Where does it lead? That's right. You've got universal oversight. If that's what it is. And if that's what it is, then we ought to believe it and practice it. So he's speaking to the elders, and instead of Roman Catholicism, we'll have Ephesian Catholicism, because these are elders in Ephesus. Now, the elders in Thessalonica might not really agree with this. Or the elders in Jerusalem. But that's, if that's where it leads, then that's the consequence of it. So he does use the word church here in verse 28. The word church is a collective noun. What is he collecting with that word based on that verse? That's right. Those purchased with Christ's blood, people, saints, the redeemed. So, on that very verse, he's talking about a collective composed of people purchased by the blood of Christ. But wait a minute, isn't the church universal a group of people purchased by the blood of Christ? But we're saying the church at Ephesus was a group of people purchased by the blood of Christ. How can they both be true? What? They're different churches? There's a little thing we've talked about time and time again. Specifics do not exclude. Because the church at Ephesus is a group of purchased people, doesn't exclude, as Rocky said, the word church being used in another way to include all purchased people. Now there's another, I'll get back to you. Go ahead, Betty, what you had in mind? Good. Since you brought that up, you're coming to get to that right then. That's a good point. Look at verse 28 again about these fellows. It says that they are to be on guard for themselves and for all the flock. Is the word flock used of the church universal in the New Testament? Yes, we just did it in John 10. Yes. But why do you know that's not this? Among you. Or among which. See? There's another reason. He says that their job is to shepherd. Well, that just means be an overseer and make decisions and make rules. How do you know that's not what he means by shepherd? Tell you how you know. Read verse 17 through 35. It tells you what he means. And I'll tell you what, a fella can't do that over the church in the next state and the next country. The flock among you. Good question, Todd. And so the church in Acts 20, 28 is the church. It's the same church as Acts 20, 17. He called him the elders of the church, that is from Ephesus, the elders of that church. Okay. All right. My time is up. We'll pick up with B and we'll get to our questions. On lesson 8, and should be able to finish that Wednesday night. Okay? Thank you. This is Wednesday night, isn't it? I missed one time. See, I'm behind. Sunday morning.